My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Sattar, I would like to welcome you and thank you for joining Should We Try to Prevent Healthcare-Associated MRSA and VRE Infections? Before I introduce today's distinguished faculty, I'd like to say a word about our teleclass sponsors. Teleclass education is used by healthcare professionals on every continent of the globe now. Probably two-thirds of those people are in developing countries and are given unlimited free access to this information. And this free access initiative is made possible in a large part through the financial support of corporate and governmental sponsors. 3M Canada is today's teleclass sponsor, and on your behalf, and on behalf of everyone who makes use of teleclass education, I'd like to say how honored and grateful I am to them for their support. Thanks to everyone at 3M Canada. Now to today's teleclass. Sometimes I ask someone to give a teleclass without knowing exactly how important they are and how important their work is. Last year, Dr. Barry Farr gave a fantastic teleclass. Actually, I guess he gave two teleclasses last year. And since then, I have learned how influential his work really is. Among many other distinctions, Dr. Farr holds the William S. Jordan Jr. Professorship at the University of Virginia. And if you do any kind of in-depth research into the control of MRSA and VRE, you'll see his name pop up time and again. To give the lecture, Should We Try to Prevent Healthcare-Associated MRSA and VRE Infections from the University of Virginia Health System, it is my privilege to introduce Dr. Barry Farr. Barry.
Thank you, Paul. And if you'll go to the next slide after the title slide, I start by just asking a couple of questions. The first is, why control nosocomial MRSA? And I listed a number that MRSA doesn't just replace MSSA in an ecologic niche, but it actually adds to the total burden of illness. There are now multiple studies, including a recent one that we've done that we've not yet presented or published, but I think it's fairly clear that that's true. There are several publications showing that MRSA colonization has been associated with a higher infection rate in different settings than has MSSA. MRSA infection is, according to several studies, some of which I'll show you in just a moment, are significantly more deadly than MSSA infections. And MRSA infection has been significantly more costly than MSSA infection in several studies. Virtually all patients with MRSA infection have to acquire it by spread, and isolation works, as documented in now more than 45 epidemiologic studies. So this is preventable, and if you go back to Hippocrates and his statement that we should first do no harm, I think we have to think seriously about preventing these infections. On the next slide, I ask, why control nosocomial VRE? And the reasons are fairly similar. It's significantly more deadly than the susceptible form. It's significantly more costly. Virtually all patients with it have to have acquired it via spread. Isolation works, as documented now in more than 25 epidemiologic studies, inside the parenthesis, and allowing high rates of spread of vancomycin resistance genes will likely increase the probability of both the creation and spread of more strains of VRSA. And you probably know, and I'll show you a slide about the CDC study finding that VISA strains, so strains with just intermediate susceptibility to vancomycin, were significantly more deadly than were just plain old MRSA strains that had full susceptibility to vancomycin. So let's rock on to the next slide, where I show you right off the bat three different studies, and I'm not going to sit and read all of these to you. I assume you have the text, and you'll be able to come back to this and refer to it and pull the articles. But just the point here is that study after study after study is concluding that this is more deadly even if you adjust for underlying severity of illness. The next slide is another meta-analysis. This one's about VRE, and it concluded, and again, I'm not going to read all these words, that it was significantly more deadly. go to the next one. It's another meta-analysis. If you didn't like the first one from UVA, this one's from Emory University. It concluded pretty much the same thing, that it was more deadly after adjusting for underlying severity of illness. And the next slide says attributable mortality of VRE infection, same conclusion. Next slide is the one that I told you about a moment ago. It's from the Centers for Disease Control, and it's concluding that the VESA-infected patients were more likely to die than were patients with MRSA infections with full susceptibility to vancomycin after adjustment for other known predictors of hospital death. The next slide, I think, is interesting, partly just because it shows that this patient that developed, frankly, vancomycin-resistant staph aureus appeared to have this because the patient had MRSA and VRE, and the VRE shared the gene, the VAN-A gene, with the MRSA. And the MIC for vanco in the new VRSA was 1,024. And the authors concluded, and this is a quotation from the article, "This finding underscores the importance of extending efforts to prevent and reduce the spread of MRSA." And so I want you to think, as we go through this hour together, about how we might do that to extend our efforts to prevent and reduce the spread of MRSA. Next slide. These are just a collection of studies that have concluded that MRSA is significantly more expensive than MSSA infections. Next slide. This one is finding in more than one study that VRE is more, infections are significantly more costly. Next slide. And this is titled Mechanisms of Developing Antibiotic Resistance. I list a number of different ways in which a microbe can become resistant to antibiotics. And the point here is, if you go to the next slide, that none of those explains the rapid increase in antibiotic resistance we've seen since antibiotics first began being used six decades ago. And that what does explain it is shown on this slide, which says, natural selection, that Charles Darwin, as you know, said back in 1859 that in every environment there's a struggle to survive, and nature picks the strain or species best suited to survive within that environment. Next slide. Recent surveys in U.S. hospitals have found that between a quarter and sometimes as much as a half of all the patients are receiving antibiotics, and virtually all of the patients in ICUs get antibiotics. And in that setting, it doesn't take a brilliant guy like Einstein to imagine that a strain that has some mechanism for resisting antibiotics will enjoy a selective advantage to survive and to proliferate. And next slide. And as you can see on this slide, this is just a pulse-filled gel electrophoresis pattern showing that the same organism was in patient after patient after patient after patient in my hospital. And so they survive, they proliferate, and then they spread. Next slide. We've heard about why the antibiotics are so important, and I've likened that to the yin of the yin-yang from ancient Chinese philosophy, where they view these as sort of dual, interconnected, but somewhat opposing causal principles. And so yin always comes first, so, and the antibiotic use came first in causing antibiotic resistance to soar. And so I've likened the use of the drugs to yin. And then yang I liken to spread of an individual organism, an individual strain, to patient after patient after patient, which we just saw. And both of these matter and are important in causing this to be out of control. Next slide. And now that we've gotten it straight, what's yin and what's yang, I just want to show you a lot of yang here. This next slide that you're looking at is clonal spread of methicillin-resistant staph aureus in a large geographic area of the United States. And basically what they did is they took bloodstream isolates of MRSA from 12 hospitals in seven straight states that were stretched from New York all the way to Georgia, so a large geographic area. And they found that more than three-quarters of all of the bacteremias were due to just two clones of MRSA and some closely related strains, meaning that we've got extensive spread. It's not just spread within one ward that we're talking about here, or even one hospital. We're talking about spread within the healthcare system that's going on continually throughout in large regions of the country. Next slide. So with all those things in mind, we'll contemplate various control measures. On this slide, it says possible control measures. One of those is controlling in, stopping the flow of the antibiotics. I will suggest to you that even if we stop all of the inappropriate and excessive use of the antibiotics, we would still be using a lot of them because they're important drugs, and patients who are very sick and might have infection are going to get treated. And that is probably going to provide a selective advantage for these organisms to keep doing what they've been doing. So prevention of yang is very important. And some want to emphasize just the hand hygiene, the universal / standard precaution approach. And others want to be more proactive, as you can see under 2B, and identify colonized patients using active surveillance cultures and then use contact precautions, barrier precautions, to keep the workers from becoming contaminated and carrying that contagion into the next patient's room. And we'll look at data that address these things through this hour. So next slide. And this next slide says the risk of acquiring MRSA from an MRSA colonized roommate. Once again, I'm not going to read all the words on the slide. You have the text. You can go back and read them later. The bottom line here is that if you're in the room with somebody who happens to have MRSA and the patient's not isolated, then according to the results of this study, the patients in that room were significantly more likely to end up with MRSA. Next slide. And if you look, the typing in this study, molecular typing was requested, but it hadn't been done yet. And if you look at the antibiogram, that suggested that the roommates had the same organism. And we can come back during the questions if you want to ask questions about why I think that this might be telling the truth. Next slide. This just shows a graph of MRSA being high and then soaring still higher, and it's gone even higher every year as we've looked at it. Next slide. The slide that we're on right now says quinolone exposure preferentially selects for MRSA carriage. So some say, well, let's get rid of quinolones. But as you may know, quinolones are extremely popular, and they're also extremely popular among some who think that they're controlling antibiotic use in an optimal way. So this becomes fairly complex. Next slide. And if you look for consistency of evidence in the published literature, and this study that we're on now says MRSA control via antibiotic control, what I've done is I've listed several studies that have concluded that controlling antibiotics had some impact and may have lowered MRSA rates. But I just want to point out that there are relatively few of these. And one of these that showed the most impressive relative reduction in MRSA rates, it was during the first year of an antibiotic control program. After being recontacted to see what had happened several years later, the investigator communicated that actually the rates had gone up and they were quite high. And so not what I would call consistency of evidence in all of the studies. So if we're not going to be able to rely and bank on controlling yin, we have to think about yang. So next slide. And I always like to start with this table from the University of Virginia. The first MRSA arrived at this hospital in March of 1978. So you can see in 77 there were none. In 79, there were more than in 78, and in 80, there were still more than in 79, and it got to where it was almost half of the Staph aureus infections in the hospital. You can see it was 40% of the bloodstream infections and 49% of the surgical site infections. That was despite isolating patients known to have MRSA from clinical cultures. It just kept getting worse and worse and still worse. Next slide. And you can see that when they began to use active surveillance cultures to detect colonized patients and isolated those patients, what happened? It began to be progressively controlled, and you can see the p-value suggests this probably didn't just happen by chance alone. Next slide. And you can see that previous graph showed you what happened over a one-year period, but this slide says that MRSA was completely eradicated from the hospital. And that was done within a year and a half, and it was done with no antibiotic control effort. So there was no effort to control yin. And the other possible way of controlling yang that we talked about in a previous slide was just emphasizing doing good hand hygiene. And that was really not done here. What was done was just to look to see who had it and put them in isolation. Next slide. And then what this suggests is that the patients that you know who have it through the results of Klin microcultures represent really a tiny tip of a figurative iceberg, and that most of the people in this iceberg are not recognized by the results of Klin microcultures. Go to the next slide. And here's another study recently done here at UVA by Cassie Salgado, which found that only 15% of people who were culture positive on admission for MRSA ever had a positive Klin microculture throughout their stay in a tertiary care hospital, where I would guess that cultures are more likely than in many small community hospitals. You can see that thousands of cultures were done on this population, and only 15% of the people had a positive culture for MRSA. So the vast majority of these people are not going to be detected by Klin microcultures and go unisolated. Those who were detected, on average, were detected just before discharge. So they were in the hospital almost the whole time without being isolated before they were found to have it. So relying on Klin microcultures is really not an effective means of using contact precautions for controlling this. Next slide, please. Shows you a graph, and this shows you 19 years later, after MRSA was controlled at UVA. You can see on the far right are UVA's MRSA and VRE bloodstream infections during the calendar year 1999. And it's compared with MRSA and VRE bloodstream frequencies at other university hospitals of comparable size. On average, those other hospitals were about 2% larger than UVA. But you can see that their MRSA and VRE bloodstream frequencies were quite a bit more than 2% higher than those at UVA. And I'll just mention, as it's stated in this article that was published in ICHI in 2002, UVA cares for the sickest population in a state of almost 7 million people. So it's unlikely that those other hospitals were just caring for much sicker patients than this tertiary care hospital. I'll remind you that UVA, back in 1980, had probably one of the highest rates of MRSA infection in the nation, being almost half, at the time when NIS hospitals had only 2% of their staph aureus infections were MRSA. So we were way ahead of the curve on MRSA. And now, 19 years later, still using a preventive approach that all of those other hospitals, A through F, are not using, UVA has a much lower rate of nosocomial MRSA and VRE bacteremia. I will note that the rates at UVA are not as low as in Northern Europe for MRSA, where all hospitals are taking that approach. And the point there is many hands make light work. And if everybody's doing this, then everybody's going to find fewer. There will be fewer to isolate just because everybody else is already systematically working on it. Next slide. The next slide shows you the results that were achieved in another outbreak that occurred in a neonatal intensive care unit at UVA, with Dr. John Jernigan doing this. What's shown is that when patients are not detected yet, they're not in isolation, and we're just using standard precautions, you can see what the rate of spread was. It was 0.14 per patient day. And then you can see when patients were isolated and were in contact precautions, what the rate of spread was. It was quite a bit lower. And if you do long division, which Alex Langmuir said was the defining characteristic of an epidemiologist, you get a relative risk of 15.6. That's a very large difference. And so it's a significantly higher rate of spread when patients are not detected by active surveillance cultures and placed in contact precautions. And I'll just note and emphasize one more time, The higher rate was with standard precautions, and that was standard precautions during a known outbreak where infection control people were advising everybody, please wash your hands, please be very careful, something is spreading. If they were not known and they were not being as careful, it might have been even higher. Next slide. And this just points out that in that same neonatal intensive care unit outbreak that we just looked at, there was no MRSA in any patient in that unit for the next 10 years and about 100,000 patient days. Next slide. Dr. Christina Geffers from Berlin took Dr. Jernigan's data that you just saw and recalculated them, which any of those in the audience could have done, but she did it, and it's now going to be presented at the Shea meeting in Philadelphia in another month. And what this shows is that the relative risk for spread among those from the patients that were just colonized, what she did was she just omitted the patients who had infection at any time during their course, since they might be somewhat more contagious. And the reason she did this is some people say, well, you know, the patient's only colonized, I don't need to isolate that person. This is pointing out that the people who are colonized are significantly more likely to spread it if you're using standard precautions, 11.9-fold more likely than if the patients are in contact precautions. So that's an important finding. Next slide. This next slide says rates of clonal MRSA transmission. It's from a paper from the Netherlands. It was in ICHI. And the point here is just that the transmissions from the patients that are not suspected, they were not cultured, and they were not isolated on arrival in this Dutch hospital, were 38-fold higher than from when patients came in and were suspected, were cultured, and were placed in isolation presumptively on arrival. So you can see that the relative risk of spread, even in a country that's using optimal, some many would argue, control of yen by cutting down on antibiotic use and abuse, and some say they're better at hand hygiene than we are. You can see how much greater the risk of spread is when they're not in isolation. So the relative risk of spread, just like in American hospitals, is quite high if they don't put them in contact precautions. Next slide. This is just another study that's also from that same country. It's a national Dutch study. You see the odds ratio here was somewhat lower than the previous two, 4.3. And I just want to talk about why that is. What they did in this study that was different from the previous two that you just saw was they said when there was one or more cases of transmission. So each instance like that was counted as one, and they didn't count all of the cases like you saw on the previous slide or in the one by Jernigan. If they had counted all of those, you know, in each episode of spread, then that odds ratio would rise if you incorporated that into the calculation. Next slide. And this is just another example of showing success with this approach. This is from Wake Forest University. It was presented at the Shea meeting in Arlington last spring. This one was showing a decrease in colonization. And you can see that both MRSA and VRE decreased with the implementation of this approach, and significantly the p-value suggests this probably didn't just happen by chance alone. There's going to be another presentation at the Shea meeting next month in Philadelphia from this same group showing significant reductions in infections by these organisms. Next slide. Here's another slide from a Shea presentation from last year that has been updated, and we'll also show an update at this coming Shea meeting. And you can see that they've got about an 80% reduction in MRSA infections in the medical intensive care unit. You can see that before 2001, when they implemented at the end of the year, their rate of MRSA infections was rising. After they implemented, it has gone only down and in a dramatic manner. Next slide. This slide is from Denmark, which is another of those Northern European countries that takes the proactive approach that we've been discussing and has controlled MRSA to exceedingly low levels, less than 1%, now for more than a quarter of a century. And I'll just note a couple of things about this. Number one, you can see the red line shows that MRSA got up to over a third of all of the staph aureus infections in their hospitals before they began controlling it. This shows that it can be controlled. It may take a little while. It may take some work. But once you get it down, you can keep it down, and you can keep it quite low. Next slide. This next slide says criteria for causal inference. These are from Austin Bradford Hill, who is an icon at the London School of Hygiene and one of the people who helped show that smoking was the cause of cigarette cancer. he came up with these criteria for deciding that the findings of epidemiologic studies suggest causation. And one of those was consistency of evidence across multiple studies by different investigators in different populations. Next slide. This is just a slide to remind me to tell you that there are lots of studies showing that this approach controls MRSA, and there are a lot more than I've listed here. Next slide. This slide is important for us to discuss. It says adverse effects of isolation in an unrandomized study. Many of you probably saw the study. It was in JAMA this past fall. It reported that MRSA isolation patients were twice as likely to have certain adverse events. The rates were 31 versus 15 per 1,000 patient days. And these prominently involve falls, pressure sores, and fluid or electrolyte disorders. They found that nurses were recording vital signs less frequently and physicians were writing progress notes less frequently for the isolation patients. There were no significant increases in diagnostic, operative, anesthetic, medical procedure, or adverse drug events, nor in mortality in the isolation patients. The authors said that these findings would require confirmation from further studies in other populations, quite appropriately. I will note that those who don't want to isolate patients, who may not want to bother controlling MRSA, have trumpeted this as a reason that we should, you know, cancel plans to control it. And I'll just ask you to go to the next slide, which says 51-month MRSA NICU outbreak. And you can see that during this 51 months, 40 to 50% of all the neonates were colonized by an outbreak strain of MRSA. There were 75 MRSA bacteremias, and 14 of those with MRSA bacteremia died, which is similar to rates of death with Staph aureus bacteremia and other studies. So they're important costs, and there are adverse effects of inadequate isolation to control the spread of nosocomial infections. So I would advise that we continue using this and continue doing more studies of the issue of adverse effects, and that we, you know, try to insist that patients do get seen and notes do get written and they do get proper care. Next slide. This next slide introduces another issue that I have to say a couple of words about, which is community MRSA and this new MEC4 type strain that's been spreading around. You may remember that 4 healthy children died of MRSA infection and were reported in MMWR 5 years ago. This takes the strain from one of those patients and does molecular typing and of various types, and they found that there were 19 additional virulence genes in this MW2 isolate. So this is a bad news strain that's going around. It's not nice in the community. It usually just causes, you know, boils on the buttocks and things like that, but it can kill people in short order, and I've heard of multiple cases. Next slide. Well, having heard about these new MEC4 strains that have been circulating since the mid-90s in various communities, should now be on a slide that says MRSA continues to increase, and it's a graph that shows 1999 through 2002. NIST hospitals' MRSA rates. And you can see that everything just keeps going higher. And many people have looked at that, including especially the light-colored box that says outpatient MRSA, and say, well, heck, this horse is out of the barn. Might as well give up. Forget about it. Next slide. But having said that and having looked at those kinds of data, if you actually go out and you culture people out in the community, just, you know, people that are out there, what you find is a much, much lower rate, a much lower prevalence of MRSA than you might suspect from looking at the outpatient MRSA infections. Those studies that we just looked at may be a reflection of MRSA being overrepresented among the infections, because when we look at these prevalence studies, they were finding quite low. The very large one there, Salião, was from Portugal, where they cultured thousands of patients and only 0.2% were colonized. They were emphasizing children because a lot of people have emphasized, well, this community MRSA is out of control, especially in children. And so all of those are finding rather low rates. Next slide. Now, on the next slide, you can see a study in which it was done in Nashville, Tennessee. They cultured 500 children. They found four that were positive, 0.8%, and they found that having a household member who worked in a hospital was the only risk factor associated with a greater risk of nasal carriage. Next slide. This is another study from Calfee from UVA, which just noted that when we send a patient home with MRSA, 15% of the patients in that patient's household pick up and carry exactly the same strain. So there are little ripple effects going out. In addition to the individual we send out with it, that individual gives rise to some spread out in the community. Next slide. This is another recent study from England, where in Nottinghamshire, where they cultured a large number of people out in the community, and they found that 257 had staph aureus and 0.8% carried MRSA. You can see that the risk factor was prior health care. Next slide. This next study is a population-based prevalence study in an American Indian population, and you may know that these community MEC4 strains have been spreading like in prisons, sports teams, and especially in Native American populations. And this is just one of those outbreaks that was going on in a Native population. They went into the village, and this is the first truly population-based prevalence study where they identified the population and then they tried to take a random sample of it and culture those individuals that they selected randomly. And what they found, that 34% of all the community staph aureus infections were MRSA, but only 2% of all the people carried MRSA. So again, it may be overrepresented. Notice at the bottom down there that people who had it were more likely to have been using antibiotics and to have been living in a crowded household. Next slide. And then I just want to note, this says healthcare spread of and infections by MEC4 MRSA strains, these things that are spreading around in the community. The point here is just that these are now being recognized as also spreading within the healthcare setting, and in some cases causing virulent infections. Next slide. This is another case of a virulent infection, this one in Northern Europe. And I show you this from the Netherlands just to remind you, their rate of community MRSA is less than 1% of all their staph aureus infections in their hospitals. And that's despite having nasty MEC4 strains like this that can just kill a healthy 15-year-old girl loose in the community over there. Next slide. And this is what Bill Jarvis said about this, you know, putting all this together about the community stuff. He said, application of known preventive measures should be our highest priority. This should include active surveillance cultures and contact isolation in healthcare facilities. These measures have been documented to reduce or eliminate MRSA transmission in healthcare facilities and do not require advanced genotyping to accomplish. It should be remembered that the majority of MRSA is healthcare related, as the current prevalence of MRSA in community populations has been less than 1%. Next slide. So that does it for MRSA. Let's talk a little about VRE. It's going to be more of the same. This is just showing VRE going higher and higher despite when universal precautions and standard precautions kicked in. And you can see that just as we talked about for MRSA, the yen matters. People with VRE tend to have been on lots of antibiotics. Title is effective vancomycin and third-generation cephalosporins. Next slide is VRE control via antibiotic control, and I'm not going to read all this again. I'm just going to summarize it by saying that relatively few studies have suggested that implementing antibiotic control will control this totally. And those that have usually have greatly restricted third-generation cephalosporins. Notice that the fifth study listed there reduced third-generation cephalosporins by 85% and kept it that way for years, and VRE continued increasing. So this, again, is a lack of consistency of evidence. I believe in controlling the antibiotics. We shouldn't have excessive or inappropriate use. But if you're looking for an evidence-based method, I'm not clear that we're there with that this is definitely going to control this to a very low level. Next slide. This just shows when VRE hit at my hospital, red are infections, green are the ones that are colonized or detected only by surveillance cultures. You can see that implementing that approach, it shows the same iceberg phenomenon we saw with MRSA. It shows the same control that we saw with MRSA with this approach. Next slide. this just shows, it says conditional logistic regression analysis, and the bottom line here is that proximity to unisolated VRE patients was the most important risk factor. It's only two, and the others are somewhat larger, but that is per exposure unit, if you look down on the left side there. And there were multiple exposure units for the cases on average. I'll just mention that proximity to isolated VRE patients was not associated with a risk for acquiring it. Next slide. After VRE had been controlled at this hospital, it stayed quite low for the next couple of years, and then in the third year after that began to slowly creep up again. You can see it was creeping up from 0.5 to 1% of all patients in the hospital, the prevalence. And you can see that then we said, wait a minute, this implies a new reservoir, and we began thinking about people coming in the front door. So we started doing surveillance cultures on people coming from other facilities, and you can see an inflection point occurred at that point. Next slide. The next slide says VRE compliance and positivity rates. It's from the University of Pittsburgh, and it shows that as compliance with cultures goes up in red, the proportion positive go down in yellow, and that was statistically significant. Next slide. This shows, again, Dr. Jarvis and Ostrowski's data from the Siouxland that was published in the New England Journal, where they implemented this in all healthcare facilities in the entire region, all nursing homes and all hospitals. And they shut down the spread and controlled it to nothing or significantly reduced it in all facilities. Next slide. This is a recent paper from a couple of hospitals in Chicago. Hospital A was not doing surveillance cultures, and you can see they had a lot more VRE bloodstream infections. You can see that what the relative risk of bacteremia was in those hospitals. Hospital B was doing surveillance cultures, and the authors concluded that that approach worked. Next slide. This is interesting. This says studies reporting control of VRE using surveillance cultures and contact precautions. And what they did is they implemented and removed and implemented and removed this approach multiple times. And each time they would reintroduce it, it would go down significantly. Each time they would take it away, it would go up significantly. So this shows specificity multiple times. Next slide. This, again, says studies reporting control of VRE, and it's just showing a lot of studies, and there's a bunch more. I didn't show all of them. It's just to say that there is consistency of evidence across many studies. Next slide. And then the question, could hand hygiene alone control MRSA like this? You can see in the next slide, it says shows universal precautions and standard precautions when they kicked in and MRSA continuing to go up, 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 up. Next slide. I show you a list of studies reporting failure of standard precautions to control MRSA or VRE. Next slide, more studies reporting failure of standard precautions to control MRSA or VRE, and then control after contact precautions and surveillance cultures are implemented. Next slide. It says isolation gowns prevent healthcare workers, and the point here is why might we need to know who has what and put on the gowns? The point here is our clothes get contaminated. If we have on gowns, they don't get contaminated. That was documented in this study. Next slide. This is just a confirmatory study from Mass General, which found that 2/3 of the time when we went in a VRE patient's room, we got contamination of the gown, gloves, and or stethoscope. And the rate of contamination was the same whether the patient was infected or just colonized. And the authors said, we probably need to know who's colonized. Next slide. Here's a study from Johns Hopkins finding that using gown and gloves was significantly more protective for preventing VRE transmission than was using gloves alone, and they showed this using molecular typing of the strains. Next slide. It's from WashU. It shows the same thing, that using gown and gloves was significantly better at preventing spread of VRE. Next slide. This next slide just points out that the environment frequently is contaminated with MRSA and or VRE. This one's talking about MRSA. You can see in that second line that when nurses went into a room that had MRSA patients, touched surfaces in the environment and came out and their gloves were cultured, 42% of the gloves had MRSA on them. That's a lot of touch contamination. And if we don't know who has what, then we may be picking it up and carrying it around. Next slide. Same thing, if we discharge the patient and we don't know who has what and we don't use an enhanced method of disinfection, we may leave VRE on up to 16% of the surfaces. This was from my hospital, and the conventional method of disinfection in my hospital, which was being performed by an outside company that served 1,000 hospitals in the United States with their method, left VRE on 16% of the surfaces until we changed it to what we lovingly call the bucket method. Next slide. Some complain and say, well, you know, most of those studies just show short-term control. But these are a list of studies showing long-term control of MRSA and or VRE. Next slide. This shows control, and this actually will be a presentation at the SHEA meeting in Philadelphia. And I'll just summarize it by saying that Hospital A is a hospital that was using the approach we've been talking about of surveillance cultures and contact precautions to prevent spread of MRSA and VRE, and is a referral hospital to this hospital. They send patients to us, and we culture, as you heard earlier, patients coming from all the other facilities. And so we know who has clean patients free of this. And this hospital, which is significantly larger than the average referring hospital, should have higher rates, had significantly lower rates than our other referral hospitals, as you can see there. So it just shows that this can work in a non-academic hospital. Some have tried to complain, oh, you can't expect this to work in a non-academic hospital. Well, this is an example of that working there. Go to the next slide, which says studies reporting control in non-academic settings. All of these studies are showing control in non-academic settings. Next slide shows the graph with MRSA soaring like a hawk. The next slide is the Denmark curve again. It just shows that the increase is not just increasing by chance. There's also an element of choice here because the Danes have chosen to control this and to keep it controlled. Most of the patients don't know that we do have the choice of whether to do this or not. Next slide. Well, the CDC guideline, which this slide talks about, has said since 1983 that we should use contact isolation for patients known or suspected to be colonized, you can see that I highlighted that, or infected with epidemiologically important antibiotic-resistant microorganisms. And they have said that MRSA is epidemiologically important. They've said the same about VRE. So if you're going to use such precautions for patients that are colonized, how are we going to know that if we don't look? Next slide, which shows you the SHEA guideline for preventing nosocomial transmission of multi-drug-resistant strains of Staph aureus and Enterococcus. It gives you the URL, how to get to the SHEA position paper site on the SHEA website. That's free to all. Anybody can log on to that and print that free of charge. And basically what it recommends is exactly what we've been discussing, which is that we should all, throughout the healthcare system, all facilities, be using this approach, same as they do in Northern Europe, to control this. Next slide. The SHEA guideline mentions all of these studies and discusses them as showing cost benefit from doing this. It actually is cheaper to control spread of these infections because they're more expensive. Next slide. Now, this is just one of those studies that was published last year, so I'm showing it. This is a prospective study in 14 French ICUs over a six-month period. They found that doing screening cultures of all of the patients and putting them in isolation until they were found to be culture negative actually saved money. Next slide. I've already shown you this graph before, but I'll just remind you that in the article, if you haven't read it, we concluded that allowing a higher rate of MRSA and VRE infection in hospitals A through F resulted in excess costs that we estimated would be almost $1 million to almost $3 million. It ranged from hospital to hospital, more than UVA was having because of those antibiotic-resistant infections. And we made that estimate by just taking the published estimates of what the attributable excess cost is of having the resistant strain cause bloodstream infection as compared to having susceptible strains cause bloodstream infection. and multiplied it by the difference. Next slide. This study took a different approach. The previous ones were looking at the cost of having more expensive infections. This one was just looking at what is the cost of isolation. And they concluded that it's cheaper that if you take a very proactive approach, put people in isolation, like Luce talked about on the slide before last, culture them and don't let them out of isolation unless they're culture negative. And that what they reported is their isolation costs went down paradoxically. And the reason was they were controlling MRSA and having fewer people with it. Next slide. And I'll just mention this. I'm not trying to blow my hospital's horn here, but UVA has been named one of the top 100 hospitals in the U.S. for the past 5 years in a row. 2002 is the most recent year that this has been announced by this group that's listed at the bottom, Solution. They're a group in Chicago that do multivariable analysis of rates of Medicare data from hospitals across the country. They look at variables that are listed there, risk-adjusted mortality rates, risk-adjusted complication rates, so measures that you're doing a good job given whatever you're dealt in the underlying illness rates and case mix of your patient population. And then they look at how, you know, you're doing it, how long the patients stay and whether your patient, your hospital is profitable. So economic measures as well. And the point is, if controlling this and being proactive and trying to control it is a problem for cost effectiveness, I would ask you, how did my hospital end up being able to stay in that top 100 all of the past 5 years in a row? Most hospitals in the U.S. were never in the top 100 in any of those 5 years. And most of those that got in 1 year didn't stay in all 5 years. So you have to ask yourself, there may be something to this idea that an ounce of prevention may truly be better than a pound of cure. Next slide. And final slide, which is just again the Denmark slide, which is raising the question, should we try to prevent nosocomial MRSA and VRE infections? I thank you for your attention. I'll be happy to try to answer any question you might have.
Thank you very much, Dr. Farr, for another compelling teleclass presentation and a fantastic resource. These handouts are going to be great as take-homes. As I mentioned to you a few days ago, your research documents keep popping up in other teleclasses too when other faculty mention control of antibiotic resistance. So obviously, you continue to have a big impact on the scientific community.
I just wanted to just sort of clarify a little bit about long-term care.
Okay.
And this whole issue of isolation when they're colonized versus quality of life, da-da-da-da.
Yeah, I mean, I will refer you to the same guideline that I talked about, the Shea guideline. It recommends that we take this approach throughout the healthcare system, which would include long-term care. If we chose to ignore long-term care, as you may know, large proportions of patients in many long-term care facilities are now colonized with this, and many long-term care facilities have chosen to ignore that and to not take any active measures to prevent spread and have high rates of spread, not only among patients at this point in many homes, but to healthcare workers. In my local area, because we culture patients coming from all facilities, we know that over 20% of the patients coming from the facilities that they don't know have it have MRSA, and about 5% have VRE. And we've seen not only infections in patients flowing from those facilities with those organisms, but we've seen healthcare workers in those facilities with repeated infections, let's say due to MRSA, where they ask to be treated and then to have it eradicated, and then they go back to the same place where they're taking a don't ask, don't tell approach. I think that that's probably not the best approach. I showed you the study from Ostrowski and Jarvis, which took the approach we're discussing in 28 nursing homes, all of the nursing homes in the entire region, and it worked. The Shea guideline cites several studies where people used the approach and they modified it somewhat to make it work within the long-term care facility. Maybe it wasn't quite as rigorous as in a hospital, but it worked. It was good enough.
Did your nurse-patient ratio change at UVA once you instituted this control?
Well, remember, we implemented this approach in 1980. As I showed you, the original outbreak started in 1978. And so we've been taking this approach over many years. We are susceptible to all the same influences that all the other facilities are, with the national nursing shortage and so forth, and we struggle just like everybody else does.
I just wanted to ask you to comment about the Denmark data. Those data are really impressive, how they have control in hospital, but their precautions actually extend beyond the hospital. Danish people, they have actually banned all the antibiotics growth promoters in animals, and they are trying to prevent any source, possible source, coming to human. Would you like to comment on that?
Yeah, I'll be happy to. His question relates to the use of antibiotic growth promoters in animals and whether that could relate to what we're seeing. I really don't think so, because there's no data suggesting that patients with MRSA get it from animals. There has been data from Europe suggesting that the use of antibiotics in animals, and specifically a glycopeptide, avoparcin, resulted in a strain or some strains of VRE ending up in the human population, probably including Denmark. But there are no evidence that their good results are due to their now rigorous efforts to avoid the use of those antibiotics in animals.
Your swabbing schedule for contact patients, what's your routine?
And our approach is we try to identify people who are high risk on arrival, get to the hospital and culture them. If we're looking for MRSA, we look in the nose and we look in wounds. And the SHAE guideline also notes that throats could be done and could be plated on the same plate as the nose. For VRE, we look at the bottom, and we tend to do perirectal cultures, which may not be as good as stool cultures or rectal swab cultures, but they're a lot easier to do. They worked well enough to show the reduction, that iceberg phenomenon, and the prominent control that you saw at my hospital.
And how often, like how many?
So we do those on admission of people that we think are high risk, and then weekly we go around and we sweep. And we sweep people who are who've been on antibiotics, people who've been in high risk units, like intensive care units, and people who've just been in longer than the average stay. And we have different durations for different types of units. Anybody that stays in our hospital more than 3 weeks, we'll culture them. But for VRE, you tend to have to have been on antibiotics before you turn positive, according to our data. For MRSA, anybody can turn positive. And the longer they're there and the more hands that have touched them, the more likely that is.
My thanks again to 3M Canada for their sponsorship of this teleclass. Thank you, Dr. Farr, for a tremendous presentation. And thanks again to all of you for joining this teleclass today. I look forward to speaking with you again very soon. Goodbye.